It's the story of one in particular. The reader is Philip Franks.
It was 1982 when Prince Philip rode in a train to Manchester, passing right by my bedroom window, and waved at me. A little of the above is true. The Duke of Edinburgh certainly went to Manchester to deliver a speech at Salford University. There was a train line to Manchester that went past my bedroom window, too. But Philip travelling on a train and waving out of it at me was just a family joke. Something my parents said in the weeks before the royal visit, probably because they couldn't imagine anything more ridiculous than Prince Philip being friendly to us. It caught my 11-year-old imagination, though. There were shades of the railway children in the idea, of the mysterious stranger who changes the children's lives merely by clattering by on the 8:15 to Charing Cross and waving, the wider childhood fantasy of greatness singling you out with its twiggy finger. For that reason, rather than any precocious interest in global politics, I found myself following what happened on that trip of Philip's to Salford University. It was there, during his Vice-Chancellor's address, that he said one of the downsides of eradicating disease and hunger was more disease and hunger. I thought it made some sense. Drugs lower immune systems. Rising populations lead to epidemics and food shortages. My form teacher said it was a point so old hat among population experts that nobody even debated it anymore. For everyone else, though, it represented Prince Philip's personal attack upon the poor and the hungry. I noticed nobody was really interested in discussing what Philip said. They just seemed to enjoy being angry about it. Children are preoccupied with fairness, perhaps because they often feel shortchanged by the adult world. I felt Philip wasn't getting a fair deal, and I felt it was sad that no one stuck up for him. My interest in him, in itself, seemed to make such people even angrier, and some prickly part of me decided, in turn, that this was quite fun. Before long, I'd kitted out my room with a Prince Philip poster, a dozen cellophane flags, and a fine collection of illustrated books. I was the kind of boy whose classmates convulsed with laughter whenever he spoke up. I'd inherited from my parents a certain curious old-fashioned way of speaking and using words from books, and it set me apart, set all of us apart as a family, from most of the people in the town where we lived. The Duke of Edinburgh was unpopular, posh, misunderstood, and mocked. Like me. I wrote to him. He didn't reply. But I didn't care. We didn't really need to meet. We shared a bond. Brothers in obscurity. Over time, adolescent self-absorption guaranteed I had less time for Duke worship. The royal posters came down and were replaced by images of Lenin and mushroom clouds, both of which you could purchase in Woolworths at the time. But the 80s to the mid-90s was a golden age for the Duke of Edinburgh, a period during which he racked up, among others, the Chinese, slitty eyes, the Hungarians, pot bellies, the Solomon Islanders, out of their minds, and the Scots, drink-driving alcoholics, as sworn enemies. With the rest of the population, I experienced a certain delicious outrage at his comments. I realised we all rather looked forward to hearing news of his latest public pratfall, decidedly more than we did to royal nuptials or the endless births of their offspring. Then one day, in a draughty East Anglian lecture hall, we undergraduate anthropologists were watching a BBC film made on the South Sea island of Tanna that told the remarkable story of the John Frum cult. And one of the interviewees was a sharp-eyed, bony individual with red feathers in his hair. This man, I'd later discover he was Duk Nowau, a legendary Tannese philosopher-speechmaker, spoke of how his body contained a white man and a black man happily coexisting. He kept a special hut with a typewriter and a chair to cater to his European side. And behind him, throughout the interview, yet never mentioned or highlighted, was a signed photograph of Prince Philip. At the end of the film, I asked the lecturer about the photograph. And she gave an embarrassed giggle and said, yes, they've got a bit of a Prince Philip cult going there. The idea proved so intriguing that I couldn't leave it at that. My lecturer suggested a couple of books, and they told me even less. It was one cult in an area full of them. Its members held the Duke of Edinburgh in special regard. End of story. Even the royal family's website described it pretty much that way. And there was nothing that went further. Nothing asking why. What the prince needed was an anthropologist royal. Someone who could go to Tanner and root out the truths he could not. I'd picked up Nako, son of the chief of Yochnanan village, in the capital, Port Vila, and we'd flown to Tanner with a crate of tools to build a school. That was part of the reason for my visit, anyway. I'd paid for Nako's flights, and the deal was that he'd be my guide and interpreter. After a steeply uphill road trip, we reached the village. We dismounted in its Nakamal, a huge circular meeting space outside the settlement. Nako gave a high-pitched yodel, and the surrounding bush turned dreamlike into a crowd of approaching people, men and women, glistening from their work in the terraced yam gardens. A circle formed around me. Everyone settled down for a good stare. So this was the Man Ples, the people of the area. The adults looked strong, and the children looked happy. What I mainly noticed, though, were the T-shirts. Yochnanan lies deep in custom territory. The word is Bishlama Pidgin, from the English word custom, and it means the old-school way of doing things. Traditional dress, meaning not much dress at all. Traditional ways, based on exchanging root vegetables and daughters with one's neighbours at periodic festivals. A dislike of money, a distrust of government, education, imported religion. Custom also serves to separate certain groups of people from others, for on Tanna the political map shifts hourly. Under intense scrutiny, I unzipped one of my bags and withdrew two packages. The first contained lollipops for the kids. The second contained short, white clay pipes, an essential style accessory for the custom-conscious dude. There ensued a scene like the opening moments of Harrod's sale, with men and children clambering over one another in their rush to inspect my wares. A pipe was shattered. A toddler had his lolly snatched from his hands and set up a howl. There was a shout from the path that led into the village. Tough little lopsided Nako stiffened. A thin-limbed old man paced towards us. Dressed in a grey tracksuit top and a faded sarong, he held the hem of the lower garment delicately as he walked, like a Buddhist monk. The villagers stilled. I guessed this was Chief Jack Neaver, last surviving founder of the Prince Philip cult. Chief Jack padded closer, and the crowd parted. He gave me a gruff nod, glanced towards the bubble wrap at my feet, and made a pronouncement. Within moments, every pipe that had been taken up was gently replaced in the bag. Chief Jack squatted down and motioned to me to do the same. He spoke directly to me in the local tongue. It was a very long speech. When he'd finished, all the men slapped their shins. He says, "Hello," Nako translated, squatting at my side. Was that it? Nako rolled his eyes. "He will raise a big meeting, a big tok-tok, for the big men, and the pipes from Philip will be passed into the hands of the Man Ples. They're not Philip's pipes, they're..." "And he says that he had a dream of you." "A dream?" I'd heard Tanna was a market garden of religious movements, its seers seeking inspiration in dreams and drug-induced reveries. "Can I ask him what the dream was?" "No." The chief took my hand. His felt like leaves, cool and dry. And then he spoke in Bishlama, the English-based pidgin that helps the people of the Vanuatu archipelago, with their 80 islands and their 118 languages, understand one another. "Bilip," he said. "Me wantum com." "Philip, I want him to come." Then he tapped the ground and pointed at me. "What brought you here?" Long story, I said. They understood, because the words mean the same in Bishlama. And they laughed at that, and settled down around us on logs and stones, in that windy, dusty meeting ground, rubbing their hands. I offered a brief outline of my mission, and explained that I came bearing a crate of tools for building a new school. Now, Chief Jack said, it is time for Kaffa. Tana's Kaffa has a formidable reputation throughout Melanesia. Kaffa roots are carefully scrubbed with coconut fibre to remove the harmful alkaloids, hacked into chunks, and then chewed by virgin boys. The resultant mixture of saliva, mud, and fibre was strained through a mesh, mixed with water from a petrol can, and then drunk straight from a coconut shell. I was directed to swallow the contents of the shell in one gulp. My throat had different ideas, though, and caused me to spray a liberal portion over the ground and the feet of the men standing closest to me. Everyone nodded approvingly. The kaffa, a distant relative of the pepper plant, numbed everything in its path. Lips, tongue, throat, esophagus, and finally the entirety of my being. A fierce-looking man handed me something like a warm piece of moon rock.
"Was it?" I asked.
"Nahunu," he answered gruffly. Staring at the object in my hand, I dimly recalled having heard the word before. Kirk Huffman, an anthropologist with decades of experience in the area, had kindly briefed me when I'd passed through Sydney. The Nahunu's a little bit of cooked food. You eat it straight after the kaffa. Means you get some dinner inside you before your appetite goes.
Everybody is quiet in the Nakamal,
hissed a big, awkward man who'd introduced himself as Siaka.
No speak.
He promptly stubbed his toe on a jagged log and swore loudly. When someone lobbed a stick at him, he dropped his voice.
Everybody, listen to the kaffa.
The kaffa was writhing in my ribcage. I wanted to bellow, to hop from foot to foot. And then, just as suddenly, I wanted to do none of the above. It wasn't that I couldn't move, or speak, so much as that I'd lost all desire to. If I did anything, scratched my ear, or flexed my jaw, I found that seconds later, I'd frozen in the act, lost upon a wind of thoughts so loud, so clear, they seemed to come from outside myself. I was listening, I guessed, to the kaffa.
Me like a mew,
hissed an urgent voice among the trees. It was Siaka.
Perhaps you are the other half of me, he said,
explaining that all Tana men had a doppelganger, sometimes on the other side of the earth, whose strength and brain power they could dip into by spiritual means. That was why they were so strong, why the Americans had wanted to recruit them above all other islanders during the war. It was why Tana men and white men had a secret bond.
Why are you smiling?
He asked. I've just started work.
Philip Franks was reading the first extract from Man Belong Mrs. Queen by Matthew Baylis. It was abridged and produced by Jill Waters and is a Waters Company production for BBC Radio 4, where the shipping bulletin follows sailing by. And now the shipping forecast issued by the Met Office on behalf of the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency at 0015 on today, Tuesday, the 31st of December. There are warnings of gales in all areas except Trafalgar. The general synopsis at 1800, low 350 miles west of Rockall 964, expected 150 miles west of Rockall 965 by 1800 on Tuesday. Low 40s 986, moving north and losing its identity. The area forecasts for the next 24 hours. Viking, north at Cirra, south at Cirra, 40s. Cyclonic, becoming westerly, 7 to severe gale 9, occasionally storm 10 at first in south at Cirra and 40s, decreasing 5, backing southeasterly 6 to gale 8 later. Rain or showers, moderate or good, occasionally poor. Cromarty, 4th Tyne. Northwest, backing south or southeast 5 to 7, occasionally gale 8 later. Rain or showers, good, occasionally poor. Dogger, Fisher, German Bight. Southwest, gale 8 to storm 10, decreasing 5 to 7, backing south or southeast 6 to gale 8 later. Rain or showers, good, occasionally poor. Humber, Thames, Dover. Southwest 5 to 7, backing south 6 to gale 8, perhaps severe gale 9 later. Rain or showers, good, occasionally poor. White, Portland.